Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, places, and stories and events in our Central Iowa community. I am Mike Metz, your host for this hour, along with engineer Mike Murphy and Pat Schlerbaum, Milford Township's resident naturalist and good neighbor. Anna Magnuson, alias Anna Banana, has peeled through the internet to join our bunch via Zoom. Greetings to you all.
Greetings, Mike.
And later in the hour, Anna will share her heart-to-heart and tune-in Tuesday messages. Who dat?
Anna Banana here.
My grandma and your grandma were sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. You're talking about henna, henna, henna. Aiko, aiko, ande. Giacomo Fino, anale. Giacomo Finale. Look at my king all dressed in red. Aiko, aiko, ande. I bet you $5 he'll kill you dead. Giacomo Finale. Talking about henna, 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 henna. Aiko, aiko, ande. Giacomo Fino, anale. Giacomo Finale. My flag boy and your flag boy sitting by the fire. My flag boy to your flag boy, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. You're talking about henna, 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 henna. Aiko, aiko, ande. Giacomo Fino, anane. Giacomo Finale. See that guy all dressed in green. Aiko, aiko, ande. He's not a man, he's a loving machine. Giacomo Finale. Talking about henna, 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 henna. Aiko, aiko, ande. Giacomo Fino, anane. Giacomo Finale. Talking about henna, henna, henna. Aiko, aiko, ande. Giacomo Fino, anane. Giacomo Finale. Giacomo Finale.
Hey now, Pat. Murphy here. Monsieur has his St. Patty's Day. This be Fat Tuesday. No doubt old Cajun like you have got a pot of mud bug gumbo simmering over your home fire for later day.
Yeah. Have you ever been to Louisiana and listened to people, you know, the Cajun?
Oh, you betcha, man. Mud bugs by the galore.
Yeah, where they put a hole in the picnic table and where you put your shucked away. The dads, the crawdads. Yeah. Yeah. And I learned when I was down there, Zatarain is the spice of desire. Zatarain.
See, monsieur.
Well, what a, you know, there's crawdads and then there's Zatarain dip.
Well, Pat. You know that this is that time of year when some of them birds hanging around Louisiana start getting restless and develop the urge for going back up this way. But, you know, some birds never left, Pat. So to find out more, we have Doug Haar, president of Iowa Audubon. He's joined in to tell us more about the great backyard bird count that just wrapped up. Hello, Doug.
And I'll just ad-lib here just a bit. The trips down to Louisiana, when you talk about the birds going there.
Yes.
The red-shouldered hawks are so numerous. They're more numerous than what you'd see the red-tailed hawks, the other beautios. And the purple martins, my land, just colony after colony of purple martins there along the shore.
Well, and I know a number of our kestrels that are locals go down that far and even as far down as the northern reaches of Columbia. But for the backyard bird count, I know what we're going to be talking about are those birds that hang around this time of year, so we get kind of an idea that, you know, what's here, what's hanging in, and that gives us a citizen science.
Yes, it does. And so the migration that we typically think of, even as we speak, there's new birds that are showing trends. For instance, the trumpeter swans out here at Ada Hayden, Now, historically, 20, 30 years ago, they always went to Missouri, Oklahoma, where there's open water.
Sure.
And now they've learned that where the Canada geese congregate, we get open water areas right here in Iowa. Well, where I was going with the trumpeter swans, there's new trends all the time. And one of these positive trends that the great backyard bird count is creating is that there possibly will be bluebirds showing up now on this great, as certain species are making inroads into changing, modifying their migrational patterns. It's what the citizen scientists of Iowa can now really benefit from.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the bluebirds, because Doug is actually also heading up the bluebird count that occurs this time of year. That program has been set up, and it's a climate change survey. There are a number of routes that folks drive this time of year to see if they can, in fact, spot local bluebirds. And I know that Iowa in the central part was one of the first routes that was established for that. So it's been occurring, I would say, for 4 years now.
That sounds about right.
Yeah,
4 or 5 years.
I actually have a route over in the Stratford area, which is northwest of Ames, about 40 miles.
Growing up in southern Iowa, there seemed to be a growing population of bluebirds that my mom would see just outside Garden Grove on the farm. And she got so, she would take out a cake pan of water, you know, about an inch in these shallow cake pans, and the bluebirds would come, and they really liked her water, you know, in all seasons, particularly in the wintertime. They would be attracted to a lot of the plantings, a lot of the shrubs.
I think Doug has been able to join us. Are you there, Doug?
Yes, I have. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, yes. Now
it's another technological miracle, Doug.
Another wonder. I think what it was is those electrons froze in the wire and had frost on the airwaves. So, because you are way out there west of us, about 30 miles or so in the Ogden area. Well, Doug, we're going to have to tighten this a little bit, but we've done introductions. Pat and I actually talked a little bit, I didn't know if you heard us, about the bluebird survey that also takes place this time of year. And if you could just tell our listeners, what is the Great Backyard Bird Count about?
Well, the Great Backyard Bird Count is something that was started 24 years ago by the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. And the purpose was to see what people had wintering in their backyards. It's, you know, it was sort of something that evolved eventually out of the old Christmas bird count. But this would allow almost anybody anywhere in the United States and eventually on the whole planet to be able to just report what they saw in their backyards or in a particular patch of habitat somewhere. Over a certain weekend in February. It's a 4-day count period. And that has really grown into just a gigantic thing all over the world now. The U.S. is far, and Canada are far, far and away the biggest in doing the Great Backyard Bird Count. But what it really does is it tells us what sort of condition and numbers our birds are in during the winter months.
And you say folks take this all over the world, but specifically it seems like North America and maybe some of the northern European and such are really involved in it. And it does more or less give us a trend of what birds stay here during this time of year. Is that correct?
It does. And, I mean, not just here in our very cold, as it is right now, our very cold north country, but even in warmer parts of the United States. It tells the Cornell lab exactly what birds are wintering and where and in what kind of numbers. And I just checked their website this morning to see what they were getting so far, and there have been 650 different species reported in the United States since Friday in these backyard counts. So really, it covers about 90% of the birds in North America.
Well, I was going to say that's a pretty good coverage for that kind of thing, especially this time of year.
Yeah. What would be a good total here in Iowa, Doug, of those 650 species nationwide?
Doug, Pat asked, what would be the total number that you could expect here in Iowa as far as a percentage compared to the nation?
If you were doing just a backyard count, I mean, some people go out and do patch counts and other types of counts that go into these too. But if you're just doing a backyard count here in Iowa, you could get anywhere from a dozen to maybe 40 or 50 species of birds. My count over the weekend, the total for the weekend, I had 18 different species in our backyard in the little farm town of Ogden, which is really pretty good.
Yeah. You bet that is, sure, a really good count. I had 14, Doug, out in my hinterland. So these aren't burgeoning numbers, but boy, just the opportunity to see the winter plumage of the birds. And I'm starting to see some yellowing of the goldfinches. And but how about population trends? Are you noticing any overwintering birds now that possibly were pretty scarce in that 24 years ago?
Well, certainly what people were seeing, and I mean, you know, there are some things that are increasing and some species of birds that are decreasing. I know one thing that a lot of people are seeing a lot more of, I think, in the past few years, and I know this is a real big winter, are American tree sparrows. And that's a species that comes down here to spend the winter here in the central United States. They come down from northern Canada. So apparently they think this is pretty nice climate that we have down here. But I'm seeing some of the biggest numbers of tree sparrows I've seen in years everywhere. And we've got big numbers in our backyard, too.
Yeah, it's the first year for tree sparrows where I live. My neighbor here at Mike Metz's, he's had them a few years. But it was the first time for the tree sparrows where I live.
Yeah, and to add to the tree sparrows, I also had Harris sparrows and, of course, juncos. A lot of folks don't realize juncos are sparrows as well. But one that I've had in the last year or so, and some folks are starting to see, are the Eurasian tree sparrows. I've got three in my little flock of about, mixed flock of about 40, 45 house sparrows.
How would you identify those Eurasian tree sparrows, Mike?
Well, the easiest way is they have this little black patch on the white side of their head on their I call it a little black cheek patch. That's probably the biggest mark, and then the top of their head is a different coloration. It's more of a brown than the house sparrow. Have you seen those, Doug?
Not in our yard, but I mean they're spreading west in Iowa. You know, just a couple of years ago, they weren't being seen in Boone County, and now they're being seen in quite a few places in Boone County. I don't think they've gotten quite as far west as Ogden yet, but yeah, we have about 45 house sparrows in our backyard too, so I'm watching every day with my binoculars to see if I can see that little rectangular face patch if I've got a Eurasian tree sparrow here.
Yeah, it's I've got a few friends that the first time they've seen him, when they stop, they go, "That's a cute little bird."
They are.
It may have a more of a welcoming effect than, say, some folks with their house finches and their Eurasian collared doves, but that are in the area. Well, Doug, we're going to be wrapping this up here. Is there anything else you'd like to let our listeners know before we fly the coop, so to speak?
Well, one thing is we just would like to see more and more people entering or taking part of this in the future. These things are run every February, so let's hope maybe getting the word spread around will get more people in Ames and Boone and Nevada interested in doing this. We can get a little more information about what's going on right here in our part of central Iowa.
Well, to follow up on that, are there a couple of places folks can go to find out more information? I know there's a few websites out there.
Yeah, there are. The Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology's website, but the easiest thing to go to do is just go to a website whose link is birdcount.org, birdcount.org, and that will take you right to the home page for the Great Backyard Bird Count, and it'll tell you how to do it in the future if you want to do it.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us today, Doug, president of the Iowa Audubon, and we will say good birding to you.
Okay, and thanks to you, too.
As the hawk and eagle fly off into our morning sunrise, we've got Jeff White, Skunk River Paddlers, going to be joining us right now. And he's going to talk to us about a small craft dock at Ada Hayden. But there's some special features about this. Hello, Jeff. Can you please tell us who the Skunk River Paddlers are and what your project involves?
Good morning, Mike.
Good.
Well, Skunk River Paddlers are a kind of loosely organized group. We're centered in Ames, and we paddle it on the Skunk River, Ada Hayden, actually all over the state, sometimes out of the state. And we meet on Wednesday evenings, weather permitting, at Ada Hayden, and paddle around and share food, fellowship, and so we've been as an organization for, 20 years now, I suppose.
Now, Jeff, and, I have joined you in the past on a river trip, and also we did an open, as part of the McFarland Story County Conservation, we were volunteers to get some folks out in canoes and such. But this time of year, Jeff, when I grew up in northeastern Wisconsin, we had ice boats. So Skunk River Paddlers don't have ice boats, do they?
No. Well, we've gone on the ice certainly before. And we do hikes and bicycle trips and
sure,
volunteer for stuff. So we're busy year round. It's just been 2020 was kind of a rough year.
Yeah. Well, tell me, Jeff, what is this project that the Skunk River Paddlers is involved in over at Ada Hayden?
Well, we're trying to install or working to install what you'd call a accessible dock. That is an ADA, American for Disabilities Act dock that would allow more people to use the water, to get in and out of boats easily, small boats, kayaks and canoes, get their boats down to the water, get into them, paddle around and get out of the water much more easily. Right now, if you have bad knees, if you're wheelchair bound, if you have balance problems, it's rough getting in and out of a boat at Ada Hayden. Water gets deep real fast. It's, rough gravel getting into there. So there are accessible docks made and sold that can really help. And we have picked one, and we're working with the city and partners all around the area, and we're hoping to get this thing installed this year.
Okay. Are you collaborating with other entities or other groups to try to raise the rest of the funds for this project?
Oh, we're collaborating with everybody and the dog. Essentially, our partner in all of this is OASCO, the Outdoor Alliance of Story County, who's a 501c3 organization and can take contributions and donations. Oh, and with Friends of Ada Hayden, Jack's Outdoor Gear, many organizations we've approached and are supporting us. And we are well on our way. Plus, of course, the City of Ames, who are supporting this idea financially and with many resources.
That sounds great. I would assume, because this is a city park, that they would be involved in that venture. Do you have an estimate of about how far along, percentage-wise, you've gotten to reach the goal that you need?
Well, we are close to 90% of our funds committed from either the city or donations from different people or commitments. So we're moving along. We still have a ways to go, but I feel pretty confident that we're going to get there.
Okay. How can other folks who maybe aren't directly involved with those groups, how can they become involved? Are there places, or can they just contact the Outdoor Alliance of Story County to donate or become involved in the project?
Well, right now there are really three ways. We have a very new GoFundMe set up, which I don't really understand, but you can get to this by going to GoFundMe and looking up Access Ada Hayden, which is the name of the group, the name of the project. You can also look on the Skunk River Paddlers website blog. It has a connection to the GoFundMe. And you can also go to the OASCO, OASCO website, and they will have a connection to the GoFundMe also.
Okay. What is your timeline for this? Are you shooting for post ice out or a little bit later in the season? What do you have a goal in mind as far as when you'd like to get this installed? I know yesterday is the main goal, but
this year is what my main goal is. The city capital improvement plan puts the money being available at their part of the money July 1st. So that's when potentially we can order, although we're hoping to order sooner than that so we can get started on it, because it's going to take time for them to make it and to put it together. So if we can get enough money together, we'll order it earlier than that, before the city money is available, get it shipped, get it built, pay for the rest of it, and get it built this year. Otherwise, it may go a little too late in the fall to put it in. The dock is it's a large aluminum dock, essentially.
So is this designed then to remain in the water year round, or is it does it have capabilities that you can pull it in and out to avoid damage from the icing conditions?
It's meant, we plan to take it in and out, or the city plans to take it out before ice up. It's similar in some ways to the fishing dock that's out at Ada Hayden now, which is it's meant to be brought in and taken out of the ice. It could get some – ice can be rough on things. So we'd like to get that in this year so we can use it and paddle with it. And we'll see how that works.
Now, when you talk about providing more usage for folks that have difficulty getting in and out of craft, what – can you describe what some of the major differences are between this dock and your standard boat dock? Is it lower to the water level? What are some of the differences?
Well, it literally is set up to provide easy access for people with problems, sometimes like me. It has a gentle ramp, 1 to 12 slope going down to the floating dock itself. It has a ramp on rollers on which a boat can be taken down and back up easily, so you don't have to carry it. It has seats you can get on, you transfer to, you sit down on. A board will slide out over your watercraft, and you can literally set yourself down using overhead arm bars and straps to set yourself down into your boat. You can then push the boat, literally roll the boat into the water, and you're in. Getting out, just reverse the process. You can literally paddle up on rollers that are at water level and that take you up and hold the boat steady while you leave.
So it's almost, to picture this, it's almost like a boat trailer in some respects, in that you've got the roller system and then you've got bracing that you can use to help get yourself out.
Oh, that's a good metaphor. Yes. It is in many ways similar to a boat trailer that floats in the water and stays there. And it has an easy ramp.
Yeah, I know in some of the states further south, they've got some of these that I have seen in operation. And I think this is just the cat's meow for those cat lovers, or just the ticket for folks that want to get their smaller craft out there and enjoy the water. That's for darn sure. And, of course, like I alluded to earlier, ice boats are not allowed on this particular dock.
No. I hope not.
Jeff, before we close, Pat was wondering, you've talked about some of the areas that the Skunk River Paddlers has done some of their trips. Do you personally have a favorite in-state and a personal area that you'd like to paddle out of state?
Oh, well, our home water is the Skunk, but it's a capricious, rough body of water to paddle sometimes. So in a lot of ways, it's our favorite. We do it more than anything. But the Boone River close by is very near to my heart, and it's a gorgeous river with lots of water and good scenery. Outside of the state, the Green River in Utah is incredible to paddle. And if you have a chance, I highly recommend taking a few days to go down it.
Well, that sounds fun, and I wish you the best of luck on this project. We'll put that website on our summary for listeners who may want to see that. It'll be available later in the week. And what I would say is, let's just do some happy paddling and hope that this hard water turns a little bit more liquid for us to be able to use. So thank you, Jeff White.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Serenely float down the Skunk River. I want to welcome Susan Guiasta this morning to Local Talk. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Mike. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And I hope that is for a good foreboding message that this ice will soon start to, we'll hear that drip, drip sound.
And wasn't that nice to think about spring and all the outdoor activities that we can enjoy again?
Sure is, yeah. So, Susan, what have you got for us today?
Well, I thought it would be fun just to check in with Corey Millis, who's our fleet and facilities manager, just about what it's like to keep up with all the city facilities. You know, there's a large range in age. We have, in the last few years, we're in the process of adding a new clubhouse to Homewood. We have a new airport, a new airport building, a new hangar. But we have older buildings, too, as you know. City Hall once was built as Ames High School in the 1930s. It became a junior high school, which actually I attended, and it was repurposed for City Hall. But it's been a while. It's been since 1990 that we moved into that building. And it's just kind of interesting to hear about some of the upgrades and renovations that we're looking at. And Corey is the person that handles most of those.
Well, before I go to Corey, Susan, is there a special interior brick that you scrawled your little initials on when you went there?
Well, I don't know what you know about the Ames High building that was once a junior high, but you know there was a tunnel underneath the street that we had to run through. And it was very scary, and people scrawled all sorts of things in there, but I don't think they're still there.
Okay. Well, let's welcome Corey this morning. How are you, Corey?
Good. Good morning.
Yeah. Susan alluded to some of the older facilities that are getting upgrades, and City Hall being one of them. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, as Susan kind of alluded to, City Hall originally, 1938, but it was remodeled in 1990, and there really hasn't been a lot done to the interior since that time. So we're starting to see a lot of the kind of, the wallpaper. There's a lot of wallpaper used when they remodeled it. The wallpaper's coming off, things like that. So we started taking the wallpaper off this year. We decided that it's probably time to modernize City Hall a little bit, but keep the character of it. So two big projects we have, we're going to an access control, which is kind of a key card system where you have cards instead of physical locks. Pretty much all of City Hall's been on keys since the beginning, since 1990. So we have a lot of keys floating around, and the tracking of those isn't as good as you can get with a modern system.
You know, that is something that I always wondered about. You think back in as history and locks, and you're using KD bar the door type systems all the way to little pieces of metal, and the technology has finally changed. Up until maybe 20 years ago, we didn't have more than those antiquated systems when you think about security. So this sounds like a good way to track who's in and out at the same time as being able to make places secure.
Yeah, and it should be good for customer service, too. We have a lot of outside groups now that use conference rooms in our facility. So to be able to kind of program a key card and, if they lose it or if they don't return it right away, we don't feel there's a security issue. And like you said, technology has been a big part of this because some of these locks, most of them on the interior, are going to be wireless. So we can keep the character. We don't have to have conduit running everywhere. Obviously, if you're building a new building like, the clubhouse, it's pretty easy to set up now for this type of system. But, with City Hall being remodeled in 1990 when it wasn't even a consideration, being able to use wireless really helped us keep the character of the building. And so another thing we're looking at is we're calling it kind of a interior refresh. And that's where when we take the wallpaper off, things like that, what's our color scheme going to be? So we have an interior designer that's going to work with us and kind of come up with a color palette. Obviously, it's something we're going to do over time, so we kind of want it to match what's there. But there's a lot of areas to paint, a lot of different things we could do through that, the door frames, the walls, the columns, things like that. So we wanted to kind of still have the character, but maybe bring it, a little bit more to modern times and go to paint instead of wallpaper. So there'll be a lot of work throughout City Hall to get that done.
Is there, maybe you've done this, but are you working with any interns from the Design Center over at Iowa State, or was that something considered?
We talked about that. I think we decided to bring in a professional for this one because we want to do some of the carpeting. The carpet's about 15 years old. It was replaced once, but, you know, there's a lot of changes in carpet, you know, with the squares and the commercial style, things like that. Does that make sense?
A lot of our issues are that our projects are longer than one semester or sure. two semesters, that they go on for years. And so we need that consistency.
Right.
So we do certainly partner with Iowa State when we can, but some projects are just not the right fit.
Yeah. Yeah. We expect the carpet to maybe be a 2+ year project. Cause we'll have to move every office out of their office for maybe over a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, depending on the size of the office. So we have to do all the logistics of that. How do we transfer phones and how do they access their work, things like that.
I was going to say, it's a little harder than just giving those folks in that office that week off because the wheels have to keep turning.
Yep. We have to move all the office furniture out. We have to, you know, do the work. Are we going to paint while we're in there? So there's going to be a lot of logistics. And for some departments, it's not that easy to just say, hey, take a week off. You know, things still have to get done. So do we have to move into a conference room? And, you know, we'll have to coordinate with our IT department to make sure they have access. So it's definitely going to be a challenge. So it's projects like that. You know, some of the painting, you know, the hallways and things we can do over time and not really impact the work. But there are some projects that will definitely impact it. We're also looking at, you know, the auditorium, replacing the HVAC system of that. Some of that HVAC, the heating part of it, is actually original to 1938.
Oh.
So this fall, we're hoping to get that replaced. So that'll be a big improvement for them and for us to be a little more sustainable.
Yeah, Jeff, this is Pat Schlarb.
Corey,
excuse me. The auditorium was one of my interests, but I was also curious about, what's your favorite parts about this unique structure of City Hall? Are there areas that kind of appeal to you more than others? I really like the old gymnasium site, but for instance.
Yeah, I think the auditorium's probably one of my favorite places. And I think it's because being the facility manager, I get to go behind the scenes. So I go in where the giant fan is that runs the HVAC and look at those areas of crawled all the way up to look at the roof above the auditorium, which I'm not a fan of heights, but it was interesting to see, you know, how we could maybe redesign the HVAC system. So I think it's really neat. My mother-in-law also went to school here. So she's actually toured it once before after it was remodeled with her class reunion. So that was pretty neat. And sometimes when we've remodeled to see where the old hallways are, because the hallways were a little different than we have now. So you all of a sudden find terrazzo under somebody's office floor. That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
You mentioned tours at the first remodel. Will there be tours available once we lift the measures or at least a limited situation in the future after this project is completed?
Yeah, I think we're always City Hall is a public building, so it wasn't.
We do tours all the time.
Right.
We typically do a third grade curriculum where we give all the kids a tour. But I typically have done 50-year class reunion tours. The last classes graduated in the 60s, so we don't have very many of those anymore. Sadly, they've really dropped off. People who have gone, like I went to junior high there. We certainly get them coming back, and they want to see things like the tunnel.
Sure.
But as we do these improvements, I'm sure we'll do some kind of celebratory event to sort of, you know, we need more celebrations. And right now we don't get a ton of visitors to City Hall. I mean, people kind of come in and do their business and go. And as we make these improvements, we certainly want to recognize the progress that we're making.
Well, Susan, tell us more about the tunnel. This is new to me. Did it connect?
Well, I'll let Corey talk a little bit about it. But there used to be a building on the other side of Clark where that was, the original high school. Then they built what they called the new high school, which is City Hall. And we would, in junior high, still use the first floor I don't know, Corey, maybe you know more of the history.
Yeah, so it was just basically a tunnel that connected to the two buildings. I'm assuming some of it was kind of for the HVAC or systems like that that they ran through the tunnel. But yeah, kids would go through the tunnel to go to building to building. Most of the tunnel is still there. It actually goes from the building about to the edge of Clark. Our Dropbox used to be connected, so the mail would go down in the tunnel. We recently redid that and went to a new Dropbox. But there's still some electrical, some other things down in the tunnel, but it's kind of part of the history of it. So they kept most of the tunnel. So,
you know,
so under the street going east, it doesn't exist anymore. That I understand was filled in, but from City Hall east to the Dropbox is open. Is that right?
It goes to the east side of Clark. So it's still under the street. Ooh,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so kind of where that pattern gray is on Clark. About half of that is the tunnel.
You know, it's interesting that back in the day, you had an underground tunnel that you could go from site to site, especially in this kind of weather conditions. I know University of Wisconsin up in Green Bay has a similar system in some areas where you're underground to get from building to building. It would seem to me in the northern climes that might not be such a bad idea. Or like you do in Rochester where you've got over street and even down in Des Moines, some of the places to get you out of the weather.
I would tell you that the tunnel was the least popular. It was not a pleasant experience to run through the tunnel. It leaked. It was dark. It was kind of scary. So, and it had to be really bad weather out for you to want to take the tunnel.
So, Susan, what you're telling me is it was a great place for Halloween.
Yeah. Yes. It was a great place for junior high boys to run and scream and scare everybody.
Oh, sure. Well, Corey, what else is happening other than City Hall? Do you have any other projects you'd like to share before we wrap this segment up?
Yeah, so we definitely get involved with kind of all the facility projects. Part of this access control system is hopefully it'll be a citywide system, but we're adding the fire stations and the power plant to this system, so they will all go on that. We also assist with new buildings, so helping oversee the construction of Homewood, the new clubhouse. We assist with that with the Parks and Rec Department.
Yeah, and how is Homewood
obviously
Club?
There could be
some
big changes at City Hall with the plaza, if that goes in the east parking lot, and there's talk of maybe a new parking lot to the north. So obviously, those will have a big impact on City Hall, and we'll have to discuss, you know, the parking, parking regulations and things like that at City Hall. And if the new indoor pool goes forward, I'm sure we'll be involved during the construction and design of that, too. So it's always something come up. You know, the last year we helped with the animal shelter, getting some temporary space for them. So there always seems to be a building project that pops up.
So is the Homewood Clubhouse on track for opening on your time frame?
Yeah, it looks like should be open, you know, sometime during that beginning of the season. Right now, it's hard to say an exact date.
Sure.
But it should be pretty early in the season that it'll open, and it'll be quite a huge improvement. I was in there the other day. It looks really nice. Obviously, it'll have a community room for the community to use, so I think it'll be something the community will really like to have, kind of a nice small space that the community could use.
Okay. Well, thank you, Corey. Susan, have we got anything else to share before we close out today?
Oh, just a reminder, we were initially scheduled to have a city council workshop tonight to discuss the reinvestment district application. That has been moved to the 23rd meeting, so that meeting will be a big one, and there'll be a lot to discuss. That's the regular city council meeting on the fourth Tuesday on February 23rd. So no meeting tonight. We have a day off, but we'll be back next week.
All right. Thank you, Susan Guasta and Corey Mealies. How would you say your last name, Corey? I'm sorry.
It's Mellis.
Corey Mellis with the City of Ames. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Tell, daylight, call me one, oh, Daylight come and me want go home. Work all night and I drink a rum.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Come Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me one go home.
Live
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
Daylight come and me one go home.
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
Daylight come and me one go home.
Day is a day, oh.
Anna Banana, I'm sure you'll brighten our day and warm our hearts by sharing your heart-to-heart magic with our KHOI listeners.
Thank you, Mike. Well, Tuesday's Local Talk Bunch, you always bring a smile to my face. And I just have to say to Corey and Susan, I could use an interior refresh myself. But it is Tune In Tuesday as I try and tempt you to listen to KHOI. Now, earlier you had mentioned that today is Fat Tuesday. And speaking of Fat Tuesday, thanks to you and Pat giving me a big old cinnamon roll from the Dutch Oven Bakery and a canister of the most delicious toffee that is gooder than grandma's, well, you just call me Fat Anna. But that is very rude because I want to say thank you for those treats. Now, speaking of treats, this is also known as Shrove Tuesday. It's the day before Ash Wednesday, the first day of Lent, observed in many countries. So one of the traditions is eating pancakes. You might not know this. So what does pancakes have to do with Tune In Tuesday? Well, the same thing as love is a many splendored thing. But here is a heart-to-heart poem titled Song of the Pancake Man in honor of Shrove Tuesday and eating pancakes. I'm the pancake man, and I do what I can. Eat pancakes by the score. I bake them brown and swallow them down. And loudly call for more. I'll lay my steak. That's a million cakes I can eat between two naps. Then call for more. 1,000,004 or 1,000,005 perhaps. It makes me fat. And more than that, I'm jolly through and through. I've been known to laugh for a year and a half. Or why not call it two? Oh, I long for a cake as big as they make. Say 50 townships wide. I would handle it quite at a single bite. And store it away inside. So that poem, that heart-to-heart poem, Song of the Pancake Man, is written by John Edward Everett. So thank you so much for that heart-to-heart poem that has nothing to do with Science Bites. But what is going on with Science Bites?
Well, Maple will syrup into trying to figure out what we're going to do, because for some reason last week our program was preempted. Well, Anna, what we're going to do is we're going to broadcast what we were originally going to do, and that's going to about the Ames Climate Action Plan. And this particular portion, we're going to cover some of the excerpts talking about the greenhouse gas survey. And it should prove interesting and timely for folks, for our listeners.
And what time do they listen to Science Bites?
Whenever they want to, because they could stream it, or they could actually go to the archive. But it's broadcast 4:30 to 5 on Tuesday afternoons, a couple of hours before your program.
That's right. Well, I started off with pancakes, and it has nothing to do with Science Bites, and it has nothing to do with Donna Lana Kitchen either. They're not talking about pancakes, but they are going to be doing an interview with a woman named Helen D. Gunderson. And so to introduce what they'll be talking about, I'm going to read a piece of a heart-to-heart message that's an excerpt of an essay that I found that was titled The Loss of a Rural Heritage by Helen D. Gunderson, which reads as follows. I'm concerned about loss and grieving. There have been only a few times in our nation's recent history when we collectively faced death and grieved together. That happened when we watched the funeral procession for John F. Kennedy and saw the harnessed yet riderless stallion. Another example, albeit of a different nature, is that of the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington. For too many years, the United States had no collective focal point for reflecting on this war or honoring its war dead. Many people bottled up their feelings. Fortunately, the country now has this mirror-like black statue with its engraved listing of casualties. People can come individually or in groups, look for a specific name, or feel the impact of the entire memorial, create their own rituals, and know they are united with others in their grief and healing. The question then arises as to when, where, and how do we come to terms with changes in rural America, less spectacular than previous examples, but involving the death of an era and the loss of a way of life. The changes are slow and stretched out over time. It's hard to know when to stop and pay tribute because although the shadow of loss is obvious, there is some question whether or not there actually is a death. It's easier to deny the possibility than face it squarely. In addition, many of us have a stoic heritage that has taught us not to admit feelings to each other or even to ourselves. So if change is slow and it's not certain there's a death, and if people don't talk about feelings, how can there be a focal point for the masses to turn to collective grief? Where is a symbol that will unite people affected in diverse ways by the trauma happening in the rural Midwest? Where is the event that allows us to look into the darkness, knowing that in some way, at some time, new symbols will arise? Now, this essay was written in 1990, and I wonder if these questions might be answered today at noon and 7 p.m. today on the Donna Lana Kitchen, because those questions are still relevant today as we face the global pandemic and all that comes with that in 2021. So the Donna Lana Kitchen Show, the dynamic duo, will interview this writer, urban gardener, local food and environmental advocate, Helen Gunderson. Her new book is The Road I Grew Up On, Requiem for a Vanishing Era. And this book is about farms, families, and the fate of the land in her small part of Pocahontas County, Iowa, and her subsequent transition to life in Ames. So I'll be curious to listen to that show, and you can tune in again at noon on Tuesday, and it'll be repeated again at 7 p.m. right before my show. And speaking of my show, if you tune in tonight at 8:30, you get to spend time with me for the Heart to Heart Messages show. And this is when I select songs to match to the guest messages on our Heart to Heart conversation. Now, Donna Lana Kitchen Show will have an author, and I will as well. I'll have a heart-to-heart conversation with an Iowa writer and a publisher located right here in Ames to find out if the romantic notion of living in farm country is what inspires and nurtures their work. It's almost as if Donna Lana Kitchen host talked to me about, what are you doing for a show? And let's match it up together. But we didn't. It's just by chance. So my heart-to-heart message is one of encouragement for all the unpublished writers out there. I want you to apply to the Iowa Writers Workshop, as our author does today on Heart to Heart Messages, to send your submission to Kulissa Dye Press here in Ames, Iowa. But most importantly, I hope that you will continue to write no matter what, that you remain committed to the art of writing. And if I can help you make connections that lead to you writing your stories, let me know, because I'm happy to help in any way that I can. I believe in you, you unpublished writers out there. Now, the song dedication matched to our heart-to-heart conversation tonight. Well, for all of you who need urging to leave behind self-doubt and reveal your talents to the world, I dedicate these lyrics to you. The love you are blessed with, the world's waiting for. So let out your heart, please, please, from behind that locked door. So, Mike Metz, can you guess that song?
Well, you gave us a hint in the very beginning of your program today, your presentation. You said love is a many splendored things. I'm surprised. Thank you.
You're welcome. But again, wrong. Just like pancakes, just like the song, not even close. But find out if you were indeed right by tuning in to KHOI 89.1 FM tonight at 8:30, as well as the whole entire day. Now, I'm going to skip forward to Wednesday, because tomorrow, Wednesday, February 17th, the Community Bookshelf will begin airing A Lack of Temperance by Story County author Anna Lone Wilsey, the first in a series of historical cozy mysteries set in the 1890s. This story is set in Eureka, Arkansas, during a WCTU temperance conference, to which the series heroine, Hattie Davish, has been sent as a special secretary to one of the temperance leaders. This book was first heard on KHOI 5 years ago, and we will begin with an interview with the author. The first episode of the book will be heard next Monday. The CBS is heard every Monday. The Community Bookshelf. CBS. The Community Bookshelf is heard every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 1 p.m., repeated at 8 p.m. So thanks to Mary Richards for hosting Community Bookshelf. Now, let's skip ahead to Thursday. So, Mike Murphy, are you going to 1890 this year, this Thursday?
No, you have to see last week's program for the preview, because like my fellow Mike in here, my program was preempted last week for that wonderful lesson in civics. And so this week, it'll be 2001, nothing at all like the movie.
Right. I remember that. So you know what? Anna Banana, obviously, this was a test. I did not tune in last Thursday because I didn't know any of your shows were preempted. But I am going to tune in, I promise. And what do you have to say, Mike Metz? I feel you got something to say about 2001.
In my case, it was a true odyssey.
Whoa, interesting. So will you be calling in to You Name It to share your experience with Mike Murphy and the listeners?
If I can think of a good reason, sure. Otherwise, I'll just slip him a song title. But he's already set up the show, so I don't know if he'll accept my song suggestion.
You know,
I was thinking of Love is a Many Splendored Thing.
I think so as well. And listen, I'm not listening, obviously. Turn on your listening ears, Anna. He just said he's re-podcasting his program from last week, and I totally ignored it. So that means that it is time for Anna Banana to split. So until next time, I hope that your day is connected to a community of love, care, and support that is KHOI, the heart of Iowa, which is you and me, and then back to Mike.
Well, actually, I'm going to hand it to Pat.
You have been listening
and to Pat.
Okay, thank you, Anna Banana. You've been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. Remember that you can also hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI provides a platform for citizen and public officials to air opinions and information. KHOI is community nonprofit nonpartisan media. Live streaming of our broadcast can be found online at khoifm.org.
This program is produced by Lynn Carey and Ursula Rudenberg and engineered by Mike Murphy. Thank you, Mike. You heard from City Manager Susan Guiasta and Corey Mellies.
Yep.
From the city as well, in the facilities, director of facilities, along with Jeff White, the Skunk River Paddlers, and Doug Haar, Iowa Audubon president. I've been your host, Mike Metz.
Please consider becoming a member of this fine community radio station with your financial support. Go to our website, khoifm.org, and press the yellow donate button to begin the process of becoming a member. Well, our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their...
The Bounty Shelley. Stay tuned, and remember, you, the listener, what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting KHOI, and...
We'll see you again on the radio.
On the radio.